Mobil Oil Corporation presents In Conversation, a series of discussions meant to enlighten and involve you, the listener. Tonight, our host is the distinguished film critic, Arthur Knight.
Good evening. There's no point in trying to pretend otherwise. Our guest tonight is the sex symbol of the 70s, and probably the only one we've got, Raquel Welch. A couple of weeks ago, Raquel came down to the University of Southern California after a screening of her new movie, The Four Musketeers. And our usually well-behaved cinema students turned into a pack of animals. You thought they never saw a girl before. Well, Raquel Welch is all girl, but she's also handled the student crowd with such good humor and cool that I was more than impressed. I was delighted. I've just seen her upcoming film, The Wild Party, and discovered what I think is a whole new aspect of Raquel Welch, a vulnerability and sensitivity that none of her previous roles permitted. Raquel, I've always heard about starlets who keep taking courses at UCLA to keep going stir-crazy, and I guess for a star, even this would be difficult. I mean, the kind of personal appearances, the kind of going out into a public place that other girls would take for granted.
Well, not really. Yes, in some instances, but fortunately in Los Angeles and Beverly Hills, we're very blasé because, I mean, if you see Paul Newman, you also see Raquel Welch and you see Elizabeth Taylor and Jack Nicholson, and these people are just, you know, around for us all to see, and it doesn't matter.
There'll be a rush to Beverly Hills tomorrow.
Well, but, I mean, also, I think there are enough people who are going to the colleges here who are bumped into enough film people in the supermarket and that it's not quite the lunacy that you get, for instance, when you go into New York and Bloomingdale's and all of a sudden you find that there are 50 million people outside the little cubicle which you happen to be changing in and sort of waiting to rip the curtain back and catch you in the buff. I mean, it's not, you know, there are those instances, but I don't find it just living here because there is a little bit of a more blasé attitude toward the fact that, I mean, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers and Mary Pickford, this is their stomping ground, and it's sort of like right in there with everybody else.
For me, the greatest surprise, I mean, sure, you might hopefully run into Raquel Welch at the local supermarket. But one person that I never expected to run into at the local supermarket was Will Durant and his wife Ariel. You know, those are people who are so much part of our literary history that you don't expect to see them pushing baskets through a supermarket. I don't think you really expect to see Raquel Welch pushing a basket through a supermarket.
Well, I must confess to you, I do not push baskets through supermarkets. I have somebody who does it for me, which is the good part about being who I am, because I can afford to do that. But I do, my car does run out of gas and at the wrong moments, and I do have to make phone calls at phone booths, and I do go shopping Christmas time and Easter for things, and you know, I have to do all the things that normal people do, and eventually, there we all are, me and the rest of the people, and it all works out fine, actually.
How do you feel about stardom? Let's leave the sex star out of it for the moment, but I just mean being a movie star.
Well, it's a double-edged sword. There have been some very painful moments for me, and there have also been some wonderful moments. The painful moments came in the beginning when I was having people notice me, and I just didn't know how to accept this amount of attention. It was kind of funny because there's an old quotation that Oscar Wilde, I think, once said in one of his plays, you have to be very careful what you want because you just might get it. And that was the way I felt. I thought, well, you know, here I've wanted people to pay attention to me and to be an actress, and now they're paying attention to me, and I hate it. I wish, you know, I wish it would all go away because I don't understand how to deal with it. And also, too, there's a lot of, I think, resentment, petty jealousies, people who do not want to encourage you in the beginning because you have to show them what you're made of first. You know, it's like, show me. And they make it pretty damn difficult for you to prove much. I mean, they're not about to help you, let's put it that way. And I don't want to sound sour grapes, but that's really what it's like coming up. Then after a while, when you have asserted yourself often enough and had your opportunity and proved something, well, they kind of lie back and they kind of give you a good old pat on the back and you're sort of one of them. It's almost like an old-fashioned initiation. They're not going to give you a helping hand up, but if you show them that you've got the stuff and the guts and those old-fashioned kind of things like tenacity and determination and some kind of integrity about what you're doing and a real love for what you're involved in, then pretty soon they stop taking the mickey out of you, which is an expression for meaning putting you down and making fun of you. And they start sort of gathering you in and saying, hey, you're one of us. You know, you're okay. And that's kind of neat. That's kind of really terrific because everyone needs, particularly among, I think, their peer group, that feeling of acceptance, because you, in particularly in this business or in any area of theater, it's a collaborative effort, and you need the help of those around you. You cannot do it without that help.
But when you get up there, Raquel, isn't there also the fear of being used, of being manipulated?
Well, you know,
for example, that your name can get a picture off the ground, which is really
that manipulative thing, and it's unfortunate it has to exist, but it does, and I think it probably existed way back in the early days of films too, and in any media, I guess. You get to the point where people are really all taking chunks out of you, and they're using you and manipulating you around. And sometimes, if you find the motives behind people using you or manipulating you are good, I think it can be all right. But when you know the motives are totally exploitive and that they don't care about what they're doing, then it's bad. Because, as I said before, it is collaborative. I think that the worst element we have now, and this is a rather unpopular thing to say, is the fact that the agents have begun to package the material with the people instead of the creative people combining their forces with the people that they get along with and see eye to eye with. Because you can't do things by the numbers in a creative entity. And forever, we'll never do that. The actresses and the actors and the directors are natural enemies to the producers, the agents, and the studios. They always will be.
And the agents are moving increasingly into the producer position.
Yeah. Now, the thing is that, you know, that to balance that off, you have to be pretty crafty, and you have to be sometimes tough, and sometimes you even have to be venal. And sometimes you lose. I have lost often. But I do think that there is that constant battle that is probably the most depleting of all of it.
It seems to me that your position is complicated by the fact that you're not only a star, but you're also a sex star.
Yes, that's true.
And I wonder if that puts any special limitations or obligations on you.
That's true. It does present a lot of problems, and, you know, it's just mind-boggling, the ins and outs, because it's almost like you can't move this way or that way. It really is a constricting image. And yet at the same time, it's an awful lot of fun. And it has its great advantages. I wouldn't give it up. I would rather stay there and fight, you know? And the whole kind of cliche now of just thinking that anybody who has a certain amount of physical attractiveness, and I don't claim to, but I am very photogenic at least, and, you know, when you have that visual appearance, people want to isolate it and say, well, you don't have anything else then, you know. And they don't want to give you any marks for any ability, much less your motives. Your motives are all supposed to be dead cheap as well. Well, that's not necessarily true. Why should a sex symbol's motives be more suspect than a fine director's motives? I mean, we're both still doing the same thing. We are telling a story. We are interpreting an idea, we are entertaining, we are giving a special outlook on something. To put that down is like an old Puritan thing. And yet, you know, in the bottom of my soul, I am a Puritan to my toenails. I'm the last person in the world that wants to do explicit things on sexually on camera or in my work. I don't care about it at all. But I am interested in what a woman, a contemporary woman, and the sexuality of that woman, and the joy of being a woman is all about. And I like portraying that in whatever part that I play. And I hope I always give that to every role, whether it's a tragedy or a comedy.
What happened when you were doing Myra Breckinridge?
What happened? Everything happened. There wasn't anything that didn't happen on that.
No, I mean to your Puritan soul.
Oh, well, you see, I never thought of that as a very racy piece. I just didn't. I always considered it a fantasy, and it had nothing to do with the real psychological motivations or the reality behind a transsexual or a transvestite. I never thought we were dealing with that on a graphic level. I always felt we were dealing on the whole thing on a fantasy level, and that the reason the book was written, well, God, I'd hate to even try to, well, I don't know why I started that sentence, because I'd hate to try to pick old Gore Vidal's brain. Of course, he is Myra Breckinridge, that is the point.
Yeah.
And, of course, I think after he read the book, he wanted to disclaim that fact. But he is Myra Breckinridge. I'm sure that all these film stars have had their effect on his psyche, and that if he let his fantasies run wild, he would like to be Joan Crawford and Betty Davis and
even
Joan
Parker
Bennett.
Tyler.
And, yes, and Parker Tyler. So it was sort of a mad way to approach, at that moment, contemporary life and politics and the whole change in roles of the sexes. But it was done on a fantasy level. It never ever occurred to me that there was anything rude about the material. It was all very funny, but of course everybody went bananas with it. And they thought it was going to be really a racy, raw thing, and it wasn't.
That was Fox's fantasy. They had the fantasy it was going to make a lot of money for them.
I think they should re-release it, because I think now that in the light of Blazing Saddles and Mel Brooks' kind of approach to filmmaking, which is very bizarre and zany, I think that's what Myra Breckinridge is all about. And if we don't get real heavy with it, if we'll just lighten up some, we'll see the humor in the whole thing and be able to appreciate it for what it is, because it was never a serious piece.
It might have been ahead of its time.
Yes, it was also badly flawed. I must admit that. I think the cutting was pretty stinko on it.
Speaking of cutting, we've heard that when the two Musketeer films were being shot, the cast all thought they were making one big super picture. Mm-hmm. I want to ask Raquel Welch about that, but not at this moment. This moment belongs to our friends at Mobile, and we'll be right back.
Mickey Mantle, Don Larson, Joe DiMaggio, Glenn Davis, Bob Cousy, and Willie Mays. These are just a few of Kurt Gowdy's guests who recall the great moments of sports on The Way It Was. Repeat telecasts of this sensational series this spring and summer on your local public broadcasting channel. Sportscaster Kurt Gowdy assembled incredible footage of the knockout punches, the no-hit games, the stolen bases, the spectacular plays and legendary teamwork that keeps sports forever young. Plus, a gallery of more than 50 athletes who took part in these heart-stopping moments, and a panel of sportscasters who covered these events in boxing, basketball, football, hockey, and baseball. So watch The Way It Was with Kurt Gowdy this spring and summer for 13 terrific weeks. Check your TV listings for the day and airtime in your area. The Way It Was is made possible by a grant from Mobil Oil Corporation. This safety message from Mobil Oil Corporation is addressed to the people who are listening to their car radios, especially those who've been driving a long time. In order to drive a car safely, you have to see where you're going, which is hard to do when your eyelids keep wanting to close. So Mobil has two words of advice to you.
Wake up!
You already have your car radio on, and that helps. How about opening the window to get some cool air on your face? Or pulling off the road to stretch your legs? Or walking into a diner for a cup of coffee? Of course, if you don't want to wake up, it's also a good idea to go to sleep. Just make sure you park your car safely off the road. A 30-minute nap can leave you awake and alert for a few more hours of safe driving. One more thing. These things take time, and you may be on a tight schedule. But look at it this way. Better late than not at all. This safety message came to you from Mobil Oil Corporation.
I'm Arthur Knight, and we're back with Raquel Welch, who looks like $1 million used to. Raquel, we were saying before the break that the Three Musketeers suddenly became Four Musketeers, or Two Musketeers. Didn't any of you suspect that was happening?
Well, I honestly didn't, and I talked with Faye Dunaway and Charlton Heston and everybody. Nobody really thought that it was going to be that. We were all quite amazed. And then our attorneys sort of formed a summit conference when we found out about it and managed to get us a settlement on the next picture. Fortunately, we were so enamored with the first picture and so delighted with being a part of it that I'm afraid they still got the better of us. But at least they didn't get off scot-free, because it took a lot of chutzpah to do that to begin with, you know, just to decide that they were going to make two pictures instead of one, and we didn't want them to get away with it. It would have set a really bad precedent for everybody, because then you could consign on to do any one project, and from that point on, they could use your work in any number of different situations. I mean, why make just two films out of one? Why not three or four, you know, and you'd...
Stop giving them ideas. Speaking as a critic, I must tell you, I found it all to the good. Generally, sequels are never quite up to the originals, but since here, Richard Lester was using the same cast, the same costumes, same location, same everything, there was at least a fair chance of approximating the first movie.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that part of it?
Well, yes, and I must say that when I saw the second picture, The Four Musketeers, alone in a screening room, I was a little disappointed about it. But since that time, I've seen that the audience reaction is on a par with the first one, and they're very willing to accept and go along with the same flavor. And it's been very well received, and I'm quite happy to see that, because, of course, it's good for me and it's good for everyone in it. And I do think that I'm very fond of Dick Lester, and I do think he did a sensational job with the film. And I think it's not so much a sequel as it is a continuation, in a way, of the same story. And most of the people who saw the first one are wanting to come back and find out what happens next. Of course, it's not much my picture, which I must say I'm slightly embarrassed by, because I have my name up there on the billing, and I'm not sort of delivering much once you get into the film.
They kept you alive for a while, but
well, they
eventually,
invisible. You see, for one movie, there was enough of me, but for two movies, there was hardly enough of me to go around.
Perhaps they were balancing it off. Faye Dunaway didn't have that much to do.
Yes, she didn't have as much to do in the first one, which leads me to believe that they knew all along that they were going to... Well, not just her casting, but just the whole way in which they did it, that they knew. Because, in fact, when I think back about the script, when they first submitted it to us, it was like a 250-page script. I mean, it was epic, and I figured it was just going to be like Tom Jones in one of those pictures where you have an intermission. So that was cool. And then they cut it in half, and it seemed to me that I remembered, oh, yes, there was a particular logical moment where the whole story took on a different slant entirely. And because most of it didn't involve me, I never gave it an awful lot of thought. But it gets heavier in the second part.
Oh, very much
and,
so, yes.
It's a much
more...
darker. Yes, much darker tones, as you say. And the romance flourishes and the sort of revenge and the sort of villainy of Milady. And Faye does that terrifically. And I must say it was a wonderful circumstance working with all those people on the film. So I really can't cry about it, you know. I'm quite pleased at this point.
No, I think it establishes...
Plus the fact that it gave me another film out consecutively so that it makes more product. You see, right now we don't make enough films anymore like they used to in the olden days. I hate to even refer back, but they used to just have a lot more product and people worked more. And I think it's debilitating to everyone when there isn't more product. First of all, you must work as a craftsman, whether you're an actor or a director or whatever. You must keep working. You must make at least two pictures a year. You must. And also, your public loses the continuity and the interest that they have in movies per se, also in everybody who's making them.
I feel one of the saddest things that's happening for particularly young girls who are coming to films today is that they're lucky if they get a picture every 2 years.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, they may be working a good deal in television,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think there's anything more anonymous than that credit crawl at the end of a TV show.
Oh,
you never know who's
just,
in it.
It's so debilitating, to anybody, plus the fact that you just can't progress as an artist, because even if you come from the very best background and have talent galore, I think that it's very important to work, which is why a lot of people do work in workshops and groups and actors' labs and things like that. I know I do. And
do you work?
Yeah, but everybody who's got any sense does it. Paul Newman, even to this day, does that. And any number of actors, if they're not going to be that active, they go and make themselves active as an artist, because you lose that. You must have a continuity as an artist.
Well, I think it's beginning to pay off for you. I know I was really delighted with the comedic role that you had in Three Musketeers, and terribly impressed by the energy and dynamics that you had in Casey Bomber, Kansas City Bomber.
Well, thank you.
And as I said earlier, the role in The Wild Party is still another step forward.
Well, thank you very much. That's very nice of you to say. I'm very happy and quite proud, in a way, of the work that I've done in the last several years, because I think finally I'm really getting to the place where I'm able to give a performance, first of all as an actress, not just because they let me, but because now I know how.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it takes a certain amount of apprenticeship to find that out in films, and you make all your mistakes in public. You're talking about the young girls that are coming up. you know, there you are without any sort of nurturing background, and slam-o, they put you all of a sudden into some big part from nowhere. Well, sink or swim time, and then if that part rockets you to stardom, as the old saying goes, then there you are with one picture for your background, and you're going to fall, you have every possibility of falling flat on your face in the next one. Because you don't have any kind of a real technique to fall back on, a real knowledge. I mean, certainly it's a gargantuan technical feat to make a movie. It's the most awkward and sort of chaotic situation that there ever was. And just to learn to deal with that and still get your performance on is some kind of a number.
It's just, I would imagine, under those circumstances, the concentration that's required for those few seconds of film that they take per time.
Yes, it's all kinds of, it's a whole technique, and it's a whole sort of mentality and psychology. It's a real battle with yourself. It's not even so much even an acting chore as it is a personal psychological chore to pace yourself and get through the flack and the rest of it and in front of the bleeding camera and on with something that's out of continuity. You know,
one of the interesting things in Wild Party, it just occurs to me, is the fact that you play the role of a girl who realizes she's not going to make it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a dimension to that.
Well, I was very fond of that part because when it came to me, it was a different kind of a movie than I've ever made. And it was a movie that was set up independently of any big studio by Ismail Merchant and James Ivor, who's the director, and Edgar Lansbury, and they were going to make this picture, small picture, in Riverside, 5 weeks.
How did they get to you?
Well, they strangely enough saw me on a talk show and said, well, that girl's an interesting girl, and we'd like her to read our script and everything, and do you think she would? And they sent it to my agent. Unfortunately, I have one agent who has not got money on the brain like everybody else, and he said, Raquel, I'm sending you a script. There's not a big salary attached to it, but I think you, from knowing you, you might be interested in it. I said, send it. I read it. It was a wonderful script. I thought a wonderful part, a wonderful role, something I'd never done before and I was dying to do. So I said, yes, I'll do it. And everybody immediately said, you must be crazy. I mean, they've got no money. I said, well, you know, they'll find something, you know, see what they can come up with. I want to do this role, you know, I want to do it. So we made the arrangements and I went ahead and did it. Now, of course, an AIP bought it. And I'm just hoping that it remains in its original form when it's released and not, you know, made into some commercial hodgepodge. But
I hope so, too, because I saw it in one of the, hopefully one of the last stages. It was when Jim Ivory still had his own.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just amazing because I think it's got a wonderful texture to it. It was 1929. It's about a silent film comedian, Jolly Grimm, and his mistress, Queenie. I play the mistress. And their relationship is a very bizarre one because she's younger and he's just beginning to be on the skids. He used to be somebody powerful. He's literally sort of picked her up from nowhere. She was just an extra on a set, like every other girl who's ever come to Hollywood. It's from a poem called The Wild Party by Joseph Marx. And
who years ago wrote The Setup, which also made a great movie.
I didn't realize that. But it's just got a wonderful flavor and quality about it, and each character is very distinct, and it is rather a bizarre film, but it's old-fashioned, too, in the sense that it has a continuity of story, and you get involved with the characters and see them through to the end of the plot. And I think that that's refreshing. And I love working with Jimmy Coco. I think James Ivor has given the whole film a texture, which we have not seen before ever in 1929 or in that era. I mean, they tried with Gadsby, and I'm going to be smug enough to say that I think we have what Gadsby missed in the way of a fantasy thing there.
Oh, it has a wonderful look to it. They worked out in this old Mission Inn in Riverside, it's, and it really looks like every Hollywood baron's dream of what his castle should be.
But that's exactly what those people were like then. They never had great taste, as we now know the word to mean. I mean, they were ostentatious people, and they were grabbling in a new business for anything they could, for dreams.
Their idea of opulence was the lobby of the Roxy Theater.
Exactly. But it was very endearing because they were all pioneers and they had that innocence. And Queenie was, in fact, a girl who had come to this town hoping to make it as a big movie star and had ended up, you know, practically starving to death. So she hooked herself on to a rich man, an important man, a star of the moment. Then when talkies came in, well, it became, everybody was put off balance because sound came in and it changed everything in Hollywood.
The quality that you gave it, though, was of recognizing what a good man this had been.
Well, yes, I guess the fact that he was a father figure or something to me, I felt that it was very important to establish that I had a choice to play the role two ways. I could either play him like an ogre, somebody who I was stuck with just for the money and who I really despised and who I just couldn't stand him to touch me, or I could play a real sympathy with him and a real attachment to him that was very, very real. And I chose to play that I was very much drawn to him and that we had a very close relationship. No matter how bizarre it might have looked on the surface, to me it meant something very important.
Which gave the role, and I think the film, another dimension. The other would have been quite ordinary.
Well, I'm glad I chose it because I must say I think that Jim and I have one quite extraordinary scene together that where we were able to play this bizarre quality in the relationship because he looks unlike he's ever looked in any other film before. He really looks mean and nasty and just pig-headed. And
he hits you.
Yes, and he hits me and all this, but it's so good for Jimmy to be able to do that because everyone thinks, oh, Jim Coco is just, you know, this wonderful clown-type figure. Well, he's a much more range as an actor he has in that. We were able to really play some nice themes together.
Well, we're beginning to discover that there's much more range to Raquel Welch as well.
Well, thank you very much.
We've been in conversation this evening with Raquel Welch, a lady whose good looks are topped only by her total candor. Let me, in conclusion, and without any prompting from anyone, urge you to catch The Wild Party and see why my enthusiasm for Raquel extends far beyond her sex goddess symbol. I'm Arthur Knight.
That theme music for Masterpiece Theater is a call to some of the best entertainment anywhere on television. It has won more than a dozen Emmy Awards, the latest going to Upstairs, Downstairs as the best dramatic series on American television. That's why this spring and summer, we're repeating 13 glorious weeks of Upstairs, Downstairs. It's running right now. Alastair Cook is your host, and his commentaries have become one of the favorite features of the series. So watch Masterpiece Theater Sunday evenings on your local public broadcasting channel this spring and summer. Check your TV listings for the time in your area. Masterpiece Theater is made possible by a grant from Mobil Oil Corporation.